Kate said, putting the right amount of contrition into her tone. My great-nephew has run away from home and managed to secure passage aboard a Zupati freighter, the Tlakoz, which departed through the Stargate about a week ago. His father is obviously concerned for his well-being, and I promised him I would do my utmost to return his wayward offspring to him.
Well, part of it is the truth,
thought Kate, as she looked into the unmoving features of the Somatozu. I understand that this is an unusual request, but if you could access your records and pull up the destination on the Tlakozu's flight plan, then I and his father would be eternally grateful. The expressionless face of the gate master stared back at Kate from the trivy. Seeing that the Somatozu was unmoved by her attempt to appeal to his better nature, she decided to play her next card and appeal to his baser instincts.
My nephew is quite wealthy, gate master, and has offered a substantial reward to anyone who may be of assistance in reuniting him with his son. And I'm sure if I were to tell him how helpful you were in this task, he would be very grateful.
That got the Somatozu's attention.
How grateful?
The gate master asked, as his eyes narrowed in anticipation.
Oh, say 500,000 credits, replied Kate.
The Somatozu grunted and played with the ornate robes which covered his expansive body.
In cash, of course, added Kate.
The Somatozo's hands stopped playing with his robes, and the mouth below the trunk opened and closed, without a sound emanating from it. After a moment, his stubby fingers tapped briefly on his slate. Kate heard a brief chime as Jacobsthal's console acknowledged the arrival of a data packet from the gate master. The communications officer quickly scanned the information streaming across his display before turning to Kate with a worried frown. The Tlakoz was bound for Uyok in the Gresht region. The captain logged his intention of taking a planned maintenance and refueling cycle when he arrived, and then plans to continue on to his final destination, Earth.
Oh, crap, thought Kate.
Then she remembered the Somatozu was still watching her impassively from the trivy.
If you send over a drone, I'll ensure your payment is loaded aboard and returned to you.
The Somatozu nodded appreciatively.
One last thing, Gate Master, said Kate, before the Gate Master terminated the connection. I need to transmit at the earliest opportunity if I am to intercept my great-nephew before he gets away again.
The Somatozu played with his slate for a moment.
The next scheduled transit is in less than an hour. Can you reach the gate by then?
Mr. Horak?
Kate queried her Pendle pilot, who had overheard the Somatozu's statement and was already working out the calculations.
If we burn like hell, we can do it, he said.
Turning back to the trivy, Kate addressed the gate master.
We can make it. Good doing business with you.
My pleasure, replied the Somatozu,
who had just made a tidy sum for less than a minute's work. The acceleration alarm rang its shrill warning throughout the Salamanca, followed 30 seconds later by a second alarm, which was followed by Kate being pressed back into her padded seat as Horak engaged the Salamanca's ion drive and pushed the freighter to 6G as he raced to meet the departure time. Straining against the G-force, Kate thought about the consequences of Charlie and his troopers reaching Earth before she could stop them. Kate tried and failed to put herself in Charlie's place when he discovered his wife and children were dead. A shudder ran down her spine, and it was not due to the G's she was being subjected to. Chapter 15. Cathal. The sudden deceleration of the dropship caught Anna by surprise, and her head rattled against the padded sides of her seat. Recovering quickly, she looked across the cramped personnel bay
directly at the impassive, metal-armored casing of Tim Buchanan's Casper. The Scorpion captain and his Casper were secured in place along with Corporal Johnny Vega immediately beside her, and, as she looked down the length of the dropship, the unmoving metallic forms of the troopers of support platoon. Anna and Tim were aboard the second dropship, following Alastair Sinclair and the members of 3rd Platoon, who were in the lead craft.
2 minutes,
called the pilot from the cockpit, his voice sounding slightly tinny in her small earpiece as the dropship slowed perceptibly again, though this time not so suddenly. The trip from where the Glambring had released the two smaller ships had been rougher than Anna had expected. Tim had warned her that the nap of the Earth flying the dropships would need to do in order to avoid the Besquith search radars protecting the Dustman facility would be best acquainted to a roller coaster ride that seemed never to stop. And he had been correct. Anna was sure she would have bruises all over her body as she had been bounced around in her seat, as the dropship pilot had done his best to follow every contour and undulation of Cathal's rugged surface.
"Remember to keep your mask on at all times, Dr. Wong," cautioned Vega in her ear.
Anna nodded in response as she lifted the flimsy mask, which was hanging from its elasticated strap around her neck, and placed it snugly over her nose and mouth. Cathal's nitrogen-rich atmosphere was not suited to humans, but the additional oxygen provided by the rebreather would keep her from suffering any adverse effects.
"At least for a few hours," Anna thought, "until the tank runs dry, and I suffer an excruciatingly painful death as the nitrogen replaces the oxygen in my bloodstream, causing my muscles to spasm and tear while my eyeballs explode and my eardrums burst."
Anna shook off the melancholy as the rear ramp of the dropship began to drop, and her ears were assaulted by the high-pitched whistle of atmosphere screaming past the dropship. Through the opening ramp, Anna got her first glimpse of the surface of Cathal as it flew past apparently only inches from the dropship's floor. Everything appeared to be covered in a yellow hue, a rocky surface with no sign of vegetation.
1 minute,
the pilot's voice said, and, as if taking that as their cue, the assembled Caspers turned as one to face the ramp, completely blocking her view of the ground rushing past.
"Remain in your seat with your belts fastened, Doctor, until I tell you to release them. Then follow me down the ramp. Remember, each of these Caspers weighs 900 pounds. So watch where you're going. We don't need any little accidents, do we?"
"Damn right we don't,"
mumbled Anna as the whole dropship swayed. The pilot raised the nose sharply, dropping the tail as the craft lost its forward momentum. A fraction of a second before the engine stalled, the pilot brought the nose horizontal again, and the dropship dropped onto its now deployed skids, bouncing slightly. Tim Buchanan charged down the ramp and, clearing the dropship's tail, activated his 20-millimeter magnetic accelerator cannon, which swung into place over his right shoulder. Next, he pushed out his left arm, where the underslung 8-millimeter gun pod detected his movement and automatically released its safeties, clearing the gun for action and projecting a green telltale into Tim's Tri-V display. Finally, Tim's suit ran a brief subroutine confirming the high cyclic laser attached to his right arm was good to go. Satisfied his suit was fully operational and ready to fight, he checked in with Alastair, who, with 3rd Platoon, had landed 30 seconds ahead of Tim's dropship.
"Scorpion Bravo, down and clear."
"Glad you could join us, Tim,"
answered Alastair over the command net.
"Caroline and 3rd Platoon have secured the area, so you can bring out the package."
Tim was pretty sure that Anna's codename, the package, would not impress her. But now was the time for professionalism, not sentiment. Switching channels, he called Corporal Vega.
"All clear, Vega."
Aboard the dropship, Vega gave Anna a thumbs up with his armored gauntlet.
"Let's go, Doctor," Vega said.
He paused for a second while Anna untangled herself from her seat restraints before following her metal guardian down the ramp, squinting in the odd, too-dim sunlight.
"Reflected light from the gas giant. The system's star is on the other side of the moon at this time of day," said Vega helpfully.
The corporal checked his telemetry repeater, which showed him the location and ID of each Scorpion's Casper. Each trooper looked just like every other when wrapped in the mechanical armor. Identifying Tim's icon, he made his way over to him while checking his suit's readouts for threats to Anna and himself. He took special notice of the raised, unnaturally straight lines protruding from the gentle, curving edges of the hollow where the dropships had landed. A trooper from support platoon that Vega's suit was telling him was Okoro, the cyber specialist, with Lieutenant Rivero watching his back, was working on a panel located beside a pair of impressively large and heavy-looking doors. Vega had just stopped beside Tim when the heavy doors split and rumbled into their recesses.
"Eyes out!" ordered Alistair.
Two troopers from support platoon toggled controls within the Caspers, and each of their left armored legs popped open to reveal a dozen baseball-sized objects. From the top of each ball, a small rotor sprouted and spun up until each ball lifted from its dock and, under the control of the trooper whose suit they had come from, whizzed past Okoro and Rivero, through the open doors, and off into the dark.
"Good telemetry from the eyes, Colonel," Rivero reported on the fully automated surveillance drones.
Apart from transmitting real-time images, the drones also carried a full miniature sensor suite, which detected enemy surveillance systems. If they came upon one, they halted, reported their position, and waited for someone like Okoro to neutralize it before proceeding. Alistair brought up the eyes' feed. The tunnel the little drones were moving through angled downward, steadily getting deeper. This matched what Al, the Ziwi Mayan supervisor, had told them to expect.
"So far, so good," said Alistair over the command net. "Okay, Gonzalez. Two of your troopers have got the back door."
"Sir,"
Rivero said, as he pinged two of his troopers and ordered them to remain with the dropships and guard the Scorpion's escape route.
"Carolyn, you've got point. According to Al, the tunnel was designed to accommodate heavy diggers in case of structural failure somewhere in the mine. So let's advance in pairs. The eyes show the tunnel is wide enough for two Caspers side by side."
Without further ado, the Scorpions headed into the mouth of the tunnel, disappearing from view in pairs. Anna was reminded of animals boarding the Ark before the Great Flood. Hopefully, this particular mission would not end up in a similar disaster. Reaching into her jacket pocket, she retrieved a set of goggles, which she placed over her eyes. With the tap of a control on the goggles' side, the darkness of the tunnel was transformed into shades of white, gray, and black by the image intensifiers built into the goggles. The sight of the Mark 8 Caspers surrounding her was reassuring. Anna hoped Al's directions would be accurate. She didn't fancy wandering around darkened tunnels for the rest of the day. The normal quiet of space was torn asunder as Striking Talon and Devil's Fang emerged from hyperspace.
"Transition successful, Captain. Devil's Fang reports systems nominal."
Captain Poe did not bother to acknowledge the bridge officer's report. The Hexshaw cruiser's commander had expected nothing less. His crews were professionals, unlike Gorak and his cursed Javul, who had screwed things up so badly on Rala Station that Poe had been forced to authorize Gorak to subcontract a platoon of Flatar to bolster the Javul mercenary soldiers' ranks. Poe had explained to Gorak in no uncertain terms that he should expect the extra expenditure to come out of the Javul's pay for this mission. The Hexar captain had thought for a moment the Javul mercenary commander was going to argue with him, until Poe had succinctly pointed out their employer, one Vitanho General Pipo, would be sure to point out Gorak and his Javul mercenaries' mistakes. By the look on the Javul's face at the mention of the infamous Pipo, Poe was satisfied he would receive no further argument from Gorak. Poe dismissed any more thought of the Javul. He was more concerned with the delay caused by waiting for the arrival of the Flat Tower mercenary replacements. General Pipo was not renowned for accepting tardiness without good reason. Poe allowed himself a wry smile as he imagined the look on Gorak's ugly Javul face when Poe placed the blame squarely on Gorak and his men's shoulders if General Pipo showed even the slightest sign of being annoyed with Poe, even though he'd said he wouldn't.
"Contact the facility on Cathal," ordered Poe. "Inform them of our ETA, and tell them to prepare the reactor for immediate transport."
Poe ran a clawed hand over his dry scales and promised himself a long, luxurious mud bath once this contract was fulfilled. Captain Cthu had not left his command chair on the bridge of the Glamring since the departure of the dropships carrying Alastair Sinclair and his Scorpion troopers, and, he admitted to himself, he had no intention of moving off the bridge until the colonel and his men were safely back aboard. In the navigational trivy, the current status of the ship was displayed. The Glamring was hovering barely beyond Cathal's atmosphere, and the ship's helmsman was having to make constant course and altitude adjustments to ensure the frigate did not dip into the upper atmosphere. These problems didn't make it to the top of Cthu's worry list. The Elshaw was more worried about avoiding detection, so he had put the entire ship on a mission control state 1. To the uninitiated, that meant every electronic system, with even the slightest chance of broadcasting an electronic signal, radar, LIDAR, communications devices, even the Glambring's mess microwave ovens, had been shut down or put into standby mode. Cthu spared a glance over to the bridge's communications section, where his comms officer and two senior ratings had their eyes and ears glued to the frigate's comms systems, which had been manually placed in receive-only mode. He shifted his gaze around the bridge until it landed on the activity going on in the electronic countermeasures section of Tactical. Jutting out from below a console, which had been literally torn to pieces, was the multi-appendage form of Engineer Laris, and hovering above him was the very worried face of the Glambring's tactical officer. The trip through the gas giant's magneto sheath may have gotten them past the Besquith radar, but, concernedly, the ECM system had become overloaded by the intense radio waves contained within the magneto sheath. The finely tuned system could detect a single pulse from a radio source from beyond the edge of the solar system. Unfortunately, that sensitivity had been the cause of the damage, because the duty operator had mistakenly left the detector grid online during transit through the intense radio-generating magneto sheath. The tactical officer became aware of Cthu's intense stare and joined him by the captain's chair.
"Laris estimates another 30 to 40 minutes until we are back up, sir."
Cthu worried his lip before replying.
"With the active systems in standby mode, we are blind as a bat until the ECM detectors are back online. A mile-wide Watayat freighter could be sitting a foot off the stern, and we would have no idea."
Cthu let out a small sigh and shook his head.
"Let's hope that Laris is as good an engineer as he tells us."
By the time the Scorpions navigated their way through the underground tunnels and were forced to halt their progress while members of support platoon went forward and dealt with a booby trap left by the Besquith for the third time. Anna Wong had stopped worrying about what might be up ahead in the dark. Instead, she had come up with a routine to pass the time. Switching off her image intensifier goggles, she allowed the enveloping darkness to fold in on her. Without any input from her visual senses, her brain naturally attempted to compensate by accentuating her auditory senses. Closing her eyes, Anna tried to place each of the Casper-clad troopers surrounding her purely by the low hum of the suit's power cells. Admittedly, she'd had limited success, but she had found that by concentrating hard, she could even discriminate between some of the suit's more individual traits. Vega's suit made a hardly noticeable squeak whenever he moved his left shoulder, probably caused by the seals rubbing together. Tim's Casper, on the other hand, had a faint clicking coming from the underarm gun pod. Anna had speculated what it might be, and had settled on a loose link in the drum magazine, which fed ammunition into the weapon's breech.
"Moving,"
Vega's voice said quietly in her ear. Tapping the control of her goggles, the faded color tones which were her world for the moment returned. As her eyes adjusted to the enhanced vision, she caught her breath as she realized the imposing figure of Vega's Casper was only inches from her face.
"According to Al's tunnel map, we should only be a couple hundred feet from a maintenance access installed to link the tunnels to the facility. The Colonel plans on breaching it with explosives, and when we do that, all hell will break loose. Stay close, okay?"
For the first time since entering the tunnels, their precarious situation hit Anna with a sobering effect. In a few minutes, people would die. In her years with the Winged Hussars, no matter the number of propulsion or weapon systems she worked on, installed in warships, or observed in the weapons proving grounds in New Warsaw's outer system, she had never been involved in combat.
"Shit! I'm walking into a war zone. Oh, my God!"
Anna thought, then fought to bring her nerves under control. Bottling her fears deep inside, she answered Vega in a steady voice.
"Understood."
Chapter 16 Non Quarta. Alastair Sinclair pored over the image in his display, relayed to him by Carolyn Verley's Casper. 20 yards along, the tunnel ended with a blank, reinforced wall along with an inset maintenance hatch.
"No chance a Casper is getting through that hatch,"
thought Alastair, as he squinted at the display to make sure he hadn't missed anything.
"Surely the Ugars designed this place."
Alastair had reasoned that if the corridors could handle the dimensions of the 7-foot-tall purple bears, then the Mark 8 Caspers of the Scorpions would have ample room to maneuver.
"Okay, Carolyn, make us a hole."
"Roger that, sir,"
the lieutenant answered enthusiastically, and took a step back to allow a trooper, holding a spray can in either hand, to pass her in the confines of the tunnel. The trooper reached up, his armored gauntlets scraping the roof of the tunnel, and began spraying. The white, frothing liquid spewed out of the containers and transformed to a rigid foam. The trooper spread his arms wide and sprayed vertically from top to bottom of the smooth facility walls. At ground level, he brought the two lines of spray back to the middle and finished, leaving a 10-foot square outline on the wall that blocked the Scorpion's path. Carolyn stepped forward.
"A mind of brilliance thought this one up. C6 explosive and aerosol,"
Carolyn thought as she inspected the workmanship.
"Looks good, even, no breaks, should be clean,"
she thought. Satisfied, Carolyn inserted a firing cap on the foam and retreated a few steps.
"Ready, Colonel!"
Alistair activated his command radio link, the blood pounding through his body on fire as he prepared to face those who bore at least partial responsibility for the loss of his loved ones.
All scorpions, Scorpion Actual, when we breach, consider everyone you encounter to be the enemy. Remember our families on Earth, and let our enemy share their fate.
In Anna's ear, the gentle hiss of static broke the silence before Alistair continued.
Non quarta.
Non quarta,
echoed each and every scorpion. The blood drained from Anna's face as Alistair invoked an ancient order declaring no mercy to the enemy, no matter if they tried to surrender. Before she recovered her thoughts, a loud explosion assailed her ears as the C-6 charge cut through the facility's wall and the scorpions charged through. The sound of their Macs and gun pods sounded again and again. Anna covered her ears to block out the screams of the dying and the scorpions' weapons fire, which almost drowned them out. It seemed an eternity before silence reigned.
Doctor! Doctor! Anna!
Vega's voice broke through, and Anna opened her eyes, eyes she hadn't realized she had squeezed tight. Anna looked up at the metal exterior of Vega's Casper, his hand reaching out to her. Taking it, Vega pulled her upright in one easy move, half-guiding, half-dragging her through the neat hole the shaped charge had made in the wall. Anna slipped off her goggles, seeing the carnage with her own eyes for the first time. A bloodbath. The mixed colors of blood from a number of races greeted her. Blue, green, and various shades of red pooled around the dozen or so corpses that lay spread out in various poses of death. One unfortunate must have been standing directly near the heavy metal access door. The door had embedded itself in the far wall of the corridor, and from behind it, rivulets of dark red blood ran down the wall to pool on the floor.
Surreal. It's also surreal, thought Anna.
Snap out of it, Doctor, cautioned Vega. Get your head in the game or somebody will take it off for you.
Anna nodded her head vigorously.
Which way?
She asked. Vega consulted Al's map and overlaid the swiftly moving icons representing his fellow scorpions. Like an unstoppable wave, the scorpions flowed through this level of the facility. Third platoon under Lieutenant Verley moved at a steady trot toward the central core, where they could move up two levels and secure what they assumed to be the main control room. Colonel Sinclair and support platoon, minus two troopers tasked to hold the breaching point, were moving to the west toward a heavily shielded section of the facility, which Al and Anna had guessed to be the most likely place for a completed reactor.
Stay on my six and remember.
Vega's Casper twisted at the waist, as if he was really looking at her, rather than seeing her through his external cameras.
I'm wrapped in hundreds of pounds of armor, so if the bullets start firing, stay behind me.
Anna gave him a thumbs up.
You bet.
Vega grunted, and Anna swore the shoulders of the metal fighting machine shrugged as Vega set off at a relatively sedate pace for the giant machine, leaving her jogging to keep up and dodging the occasional cadaver as she went. The frame charge went off, and before the last of the rubble hit the floor, Sinclair and Buchanan stepped through, one turning left and the other right, so they stood back to back. Max blazed, laying down a withering fire, while each man employed the 8mm gun pods more selectively. Designed to destroy buildings, reinforced positions, and light to medium armored vehicles, the Mac rounds pumped out at a rate of 200 per minute and had an effective range of 10,000 feet. In the confines of the corridor, it was like shooting fish in a barrel. Rolling smoke gradually cleared as air conditioning units battled to remove nitrogen and contaminants from the air, and the Scorpion saw the damage they had inflicted. Alistair viewed his gruesome handiwork dispassionately and calmly finished off any wounded with a single round from his gun pod. The remaining Scorpions entered the corridor, and none felt any remorse or guilt. The lives taken here were involved in the deaths of their innocent families and in the wider conspiracy to enslave Earth.
Non quarta.
Carolyn, get your platoon moving. I want the control room secured ASAP, and this level must be isolated before the Besquith get a chance to rally their forces.
Roger that, Colonel. Okay, third platoon, let's get moving.
Gonzalez, you've got point. Get us to that shielded section, ordered Alistair.
The support platoon commander tagged two of his troopers, who immediately set off down the corridor, Max swiveling left and right, like hunting dogs sniffing out a quarry. Occasionally, their thermal image or bio-readers detected a scientist or engineer hiding in a side room, and the trooper flung his feed to one of the following Scorpions, who zeroed his MAC on the target and fired through the intervening wall. Death had come to Cathal, and it had no mercy.
"What in entropy is happening?"
screamed Briok, the duty watch officer. As the Besquith monitoring the internal cameras pointed at the image on his display, a metal monster emerged from a cloud of dust and smoke. Yellow flame flashed from a heavy weapon on its shoulder, and where it touched the facility personnel the Besquith were paid to protect, they died. The officer's jaw dropped to reveal sharp canine teeth, and saliva dripped to the floor.
"Sound the alarm, you idiot!"
Briok shouted, as he backhanded the junior man, his claws drawing blood. The third Besquith in the control room fixed his eyes on his air defense console and refused to look at his inept companion.
"Of all the times for the company commander to take R&R on Moon 5. Curse him for leaving me to deal with this!"
Activating his comms unit, Briok placed a call directly to the small, quick reaction force located in the Besquith barracks on the uppermost level of the facility. A Besquith answered the connection, but Briok gave the unlucky bastard no time before he barked his orders.
"Get your sorry asses moving! We have a breach on the lower level! At least two intruders! Load up with armor-piercing! They're in mechanical combat suits!"
Briok cut the line, too impatient to wait for an acknowledgement. Briok cursed the company commander, for he had selected the uppermost level as the company barracks. Logical at the time, but who would have suspected an assault on the facility would come from the lowest level?
"The lowest level,"
Briok mused aloud. His eyes hunted the console, displaying the status of the booby traps he had had placed in the old tunnels of the Red Diamond Mine. Propped over the console lay a slate. A colorful screen displayed the joys of gambling. Briok shrieked with anger. The junior Besquith lowered his head, cowering from his enraged officer.
"I'll deal with you later,"
growled Briok, swiping at the slate and sending it crashing against a wall. All the booby-trap telltales showed green. But that couldn't be. Briok let out a low mutter as his claws tapped a command, which sent a fresh interrogation command. He watched as each telltale blacked out for a split second before coming back online. One by one, the system confirmed their viability. All except a perfect line reaching from an emergency access on the surface, miles beyond the search radar's limit. The line extended to, of course, the exact point the invaders had breached the facility.
"Briok! Briok!"
called the junior man in a quavering voice.
"What?"
Briok yelled as his mind raced to marshal his thoughts and come up with a plan to repel the invaders.
We are being hailed by the Hexar cruiser Striking Talon. A Captain Poe. We were expecting them days ago, but they were delayed.
Delayed? Who cares? They are here now, and they might just be our saviors. Put him through.
A tap of a control connected Briok directly to Captain Poe.
Captain, this is Duty Watch Officer Briok. An unknown number of attackers are assaulting the facility. They are equipped with mechanical combat suits. I believe they're trying to steal the Ragnar reactors. You must send reinforcements to my location immediately. As many as you can.
Briok paused as he remembered the chain of disabled booby traps.
The attackers entered the facility via a tunnel, which reaches the surface about...
Briok checked the map on the wall of the control room.
8 miles northwest of the facility. I believe they may have ships waiting there to extract them.
Message received, Briok, replied the calm, controlled voice of the Hexar captain. Our company of Javul are loading up and will be with you shortly. Just hold a little longer. Help is coming.
The connection terminated, with Briok thinking he might just get out of the entropy-be-damned situation unscathed. The explosion, which blasted the reinforced metal control room door off its heavy hinges, also sent the door flying across the room like a giant's frisbee, and it decapitated Briok neatly before embedding itself in the far wall. The compression wave lifted the other unfortunate Besquiths from their seats and sent them sprawling to the floor. A giant fighting machine filled the hole where the door once was, raking 8mm gunfire that punched into the bodies of the Besquith before they could draw their weapons.
"Control room secure, Colonel,"
radioed Carolyn Verley as she stepped over the mess on the floor, while Okoro, detached from support platoon to assist with the systems in the control room, made no effort to step over the headless corpse lying between him and the main console. Okoro's armored 900-pound weight stepped squarely on the dead Besquith's chest, and the alien's internal organs squirted out like toothpaste from a tube. Okoro scanned the console rapidly but thoroughly. Finding what he looked for, he extended his arm, and his left index finger hovered over a computer input port. The cyber warfare specialist's adapted Casper's fingertip slid to one side, and a multifunction jack extended, then configured itself to fit the input port.
"I'm in, Lieutenant."
"Damn, that was quick," thought Carolyn. She knew Okoro was one of Gonzalez Rivero's best, but still, impressive work.
"Elevators are locked out. That should hold them for a while," said Okoro, as he overrode the system. "Okay. We have 5 emergency stairwells located at the tip of each corridor at the furthest point from the central core that were not on the plans supplied by Al that the Besquith will undoubtedly use to try and force their way onto this level."
"Show me,"
ordered Carolyn. Okoro pushed the updated floor plan to her. Inside her Casper, the Scorpion lieutenant cursed softly. When she had discussed the assault plan with the colonel, the possibility that Al's layout for the facility might not be up to date had arisen. However, they had agreed that in that event they would improvise. Looking over the floor plan hovering in her trivy, Carolyn knew that was exactly what she had to do, although doing so would spread her forces dangerously thin. Including Okoro, she had brought only 8 troopers to secure the control room. 9 if she included herself. Now, however, she was going to have to split her forces. 1 trooper per stairwell and 2 for the central core elevator shaft would leave herself and Okoro to hold the control room and act as reserve force, which she could switch from pressure point to pressure point as required.
"Yeah, we can do this,"
Carolyn said to herself inside the confines of her sealed Casper.
sending the new deployment plan to her platoon's Caspers. She was grateful to see that not a single trooper hesitated. Each headed for their assigned posts. While Carolyn had been doing her on-the-fly deployment plan, Okoro had been accessing the other Beskyd systems. One of his priorities was the surface-to-air and orbital anti-ship batteries. If he were to disable those batteries, then the Scorpion's dropships would have a clear flight path direct to the Glambring, which could move closer to the facility and cut their flight time to minutes, rather than having to fly Napa the Earth. Bringing up the search radar, the cyber warfare specialist's eyes widened in shock as he caught sight of a pair of Hexshock cruisers entering orbit.
"Lieutenant, we have a major problem."
As Carolyn pulled up the radar feed Okoro sent her, she did a double take on seeing the two cruisers, and her eyes bulged. A half dozen smaller radar returns separated from the cruisers, and in a flash, Carolyn realized that what she thought had been a stable situation a minute ago had just gone to rat shit. Activating her link to Alistair, she gave him the good news.
"Colonel, two Hexshock cruisers have appeared in orbit and have already deployed small craft."
Carolyn's tongue darted between suddenly dry lips.
"Sir, my assessment is that the small craft contain reinforcements. I do not believe our positions are tenable once they arrive."
Through her suit speakers, the toneless voice of Alistair answered her.
"Keep them occupied as long as you can, Carolyn. Then blow the stairwells and get your ass to the extraction point."
"Understood, sir. Verily clear."
Tim switched to his private channel once Alistair finished giving his instructions to Carolyn.
"How long do you think we have?"
Alistair had done the math in his head. He was sure Tim had too, and his friend was just being polite.
"Call it 5 minutes for reinforcements to get here. Traveling from orbit at max burn. Another 5 to disembark and get down here if they're good. 10 if they're average."
"Third platoon will hold them," said Tim reassuringly.
"I'm tempted to order Carolyn to blow the stairwells now and force the Beskyd and their new friends down the central elevator shaft." "A damn sight easier to defend," mused Alistair,
bouncing the idea off Tim.
"Better to keep them from concentrating their forces. Splitting their assaults across 5 or more points will make it easier for 3rd Platoon to hold. If it looks like any assault will succeed, then we blow the stairwell and cut off that route to them."
Alistair grunted.
"Just as I thought."
From up ahead came the sound of a heavy weapon firing. Alistair's eyes darted to his secondary Tri-V display, where the unit's battle effectiveness status reported that Trooper Liz Hawkins had gone from green to a blinking red to a solid red.
"Trooper Hawkins is combat ineffective," reported his suit in a dispassionate voice.
"The first sign of active resistance. We're headed in the right direction. It's got to be the reactor storage area," thought Alistair.
If anyone could have seen through the thick armor plating enclosing the Scorpion's commander, they would have seen the grim face, the light of vengeance in his eyes as he broke into a floor-rocking trot and raced to the scene of the action. Seconds later, Alistair came up behind Gonzales Rivero.
"What's the situation, Gonzales?"
asked Alistair.
"We've got ourselves a bit of a bottleneck, Colonel. The Beskyd have a strong point equipped with a high-intensity laser covering the approach to the entrance to a shielded section. Damn thing must be made of battleship armor, because our mac rounds are bouncing off it like they were made of rubber. First we knew of it was when it took out Hawkins with its first round and punched right through her laser shield and armor."
"Carolyn reckons reinforcements are on the way. The clock is ticking, Gonzales, and we need to take that laser out sooner rather than later."
"Roger that, sir. The first sergeant thinks he might have a solution. He's holed up with Jackson in a room across the corridor."
Alistair put a call into the first sergeant.
Hey, Kroll, what's the play?
Ethan Kroll checked the ammunition counter for his Mac before answering.
That corridor is a death trap, sir. Jackson and I are going to make our own path and come at the strong point from the flank.
Make it happen, first sergeant.
Get ready, Jackson.
Ethan asked the trooper, standing shoulder to shoulder with them in the narrow confines of what looked like a chemical lab of some kind. Both men had their Macs pointed toward the wall only a few feet in front of them.
Ready,
replied Jackson.
Advance,
ordered Ethan, as he triggered the cannon. Traveling at 3,600 feet per second, the armor-piercing rounds ripped into and through the double-thickness reinforced concrete wall, shredding it. Side by side, the men stepped through the falling masonry and clouds of fractured wall. They maintained the rate of fire and poured rounds into the adjacent wall, which succumbed to the fate of the first. The third and fourth wall collapsed under the weight of their combined fire until, at last, the pair of Caspers encountered the heavily reinforced wall of the shielded area. Whether the Besquith operating the strong point were aware they had enemy soldiers on their flank or not didn't matter, as Kroll turned his Casper 90 degrees to the right and let loose a storm of Mac rounds, disintegrating the wall between them and the strong point. The Besquith were torn to shreds. The 20-millimeter rounds had initially passed through them, only to rebound off the strong point's armor. Though now spent, the rounds still carried significant kinetic energy, and Ethan was so close to his own rounds that they peppered the outside of his Casper, and his suit's computer registered them as incoming enemy fire.
All Mac rounds expended, the suit informed him.
Now, in the quiet that descended, he observed his handiwork. What had once been a strong point now resembled an abattoir.
Target neutralized,
Ethan called over the radio. Alistair stomped down the corridor, glancing at the blood-soaked Casper of his first sergeant, before using his own suit's sensors to analyze the sealed door the strong point protected. Tim appeared at his shoulder.
No visible door control panel, noted Tim.
Yeah, looks like it can only open from the inside.
Alistair looked around the door's circumference until he spotted a surveillance camera. Squaring his suit off to it, he activated his external speaker.
This is Colonel Alistair Sinclair of the human mercenary company Sinclair Scorpions. Open this door immediately, and I promise you will come to no harm. Refuse, and your lives are forfeit.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Alistair counted to 10 in his head. When the door remained sealed, he turned to Tim.
Open it. They've made their choice.
Tim beckoned two troopers. The troopers leveled their high cyclic lasers at the exterior hinges of the armored door. The incredible heat produced from the makeshift cutters turned the armored metal to a stubborn, glowing red.
This is going to take a few minutes, said Tim.
I know, replied Alistair, trying not to sound anxious. And it's time I don't think we have.
Here they come, said Okoro,
as he lost the feed from the cameras he had been using to keep tabs on the mix of Besquith and Javul heading down the stairwells.
Cameras are down. I'm blind here.
Carolyn let out a string of swear words that would have made her drill sergeant proud before regaining her composure.
Okay, troopers,
Carolyn said over the platoon net.
We've enemy movement one level above you. Keep your eyes peeled and make every shot count. We need to buy the colonel as much time as we can.
Moments later, the sound of laser rifle fire answered by the distinctive sound of Casper gun pods reached her via her suit's external pickups.
In Carolyn's trivy, the In Contact icon blinked alongside each of her troopers' names. Carolyn repressed the urge to rush to their aid. Her place was here, coordinating the defense of this level. Behind her, Okoro's Casper stood as a statue.
What are you...
Carolyn's question went unfinished, as a loud explosion rocked the control room. Trooper Espada's icon went blood red.
Enough of this standing around shit, said Carolyn. Okoro, keep me updated over the radio. I'm going to the fight.
And with that, Carolyn Verley headed out through the hole where the control room door had once stood. The cyber warfare specialist hardly noticed her leave as he pushed through one computer-generated firewall after another. For Okoro had identified a fatal stumbling block to the success of the Scorpion's plan. The Heksha cruisers in orbit. After exhausting two complete Casper arm-mounted lasers, the massive hinges holding the armored door to the shielded area finally dropped to the floor with a loud clang. Grasping the top of the door, the two troopers who had cut away the hinges steadied themselves before using their combined mechanically aided strength to pull the 2,000-pound door. With a pop, the door came free of its frame, and the air pressure from the clean room beyond equalized with that in the corridor. The troopers quickly ducked into cover as a volley of laser rifle fire burst from beyond the room's threshold.
"No firing," called Alistair. "We don't need to blow the crap out of a reactor full of fuel. Laser shields only."
Gonzalez and Tim stepped forward, arms held at shoulder height, elbows bent, and activated their Casper's twin laser shields. From their forearms, the shields sprouted and formed an impenetrable barrier, which extended from floor to just above the Casper's head. Locked together, Gonzalez and Tim stepped over the threshold as the rifle fire intensified. Using the two Scorpion officers as shields, the remainder of the armor-clad troopers entered the room as wicked-looking 4-foot-long blades sprang from suit arms, ready to dispatch the defenders. As the laser fire splashed uselessly on his shield, Tim spotted his assailants. A couple of Besquith had tipped over some sturdy tables and were using them as an improvised barricade while they poured fire into the advancing Scorpions. An amber warning light began blinking in Tim's display, as his shield warned that it was beginning to overload. Tim broke from Gonzalez and ran toward the Besquith. In the short distance, Tim's Casper accelerated to 15 miles per hour, and he crashed into the tables, splintering them like matchsticks. Tim's momentum carried him through the tables, and he scooped both of the Besquith off their feet as he crashed into the wall behind them. 900 pounds of armor traveling at 15 miles per hour squashed the Besquith against the wall like they had been hit by a giant fly swatter. Turning to see what was happening in the rest of the room, Tim was greeted by a sight that reminded him of the scene that would have been all too familiar to the knights of medieval times. Soldiers in head-to-toe armor, swords in their hands dripping with the blood of their slain enemy. As Alistair had promised the room's occupants, they could comply and open the door, or suffer the consequences. Those consequences were stretched across the room's floor in pools of their own blood.
"Corporal Vega, the room is secure. Bring in the package," ordered Alistair.
Out in the corridor, Vega turned and bent down to speak to Anna Wong softly through his external speaker, rather than broadcast their conversation over an open radio net.
"Doctor, this is not going to be pretty. Concentrate on what we are here to do. Don't look around, and you will be fine."
Anna took a deep breath, straightening her shoulders before giving Vega a curt nod.
"Let's get on with this."
Holding her chin high, Anna followed Vega into the room, resolutely refusing to acknowledge the bodies spread around the floor, or the large streaks of blood and gore on one wall.
"No, no, I'm not going to look,"
Anna whispered to herself, stepping over an unmoving Bakulu to a console which was beeping softly. The display was splattered in blood, and Anna looked around for something to wipe it clear with. Not finding anything, she resorted to the sleeve of her own jacket.
"That's better,"
she said, as she concentrated on the information, occasionally tapping at the console's keyboard to bring up new windows of information.
"How long, Anna?" asked Alastair.
"I don't know, Colonel. There is a wealth of information here. Years of research. I could spend months going through this data, trying to find exactly what we are looking for."
"Time is not something we have a lot of, Anna," said Alastair,
failing to keep the exasperation from his voice.
"I need to know where that working prototype is."
Anna flicked through another couple of screens, then let out a loud, "Aha!" Spinning on her heel, Anna went to take a step, only to find her way blocked by the limp form of a... Anna stared at it as her brain tried to process what the bloodied heap may have been. A large metal leg and foot appeared in her vision and pushed the body out of her line of sight.
"Thank you, Vega,"
she said, in the same matter-of-fact tone that one would use to acknowledge the removal of a piece of garbage. Alastair and Tim watched on as Anna moved to the far wall, which was segmented vertically into a dozen or so large units, moving along them until she came to the one she was looking for and halted. Tapping at the compact control panel on the face of the unit, Anna stood back as the entire segment slid smoothly out of the wall to reveal a dark, lozenge-shaped capsule, roughly 6 feet high and 4 feet around. The capsule's exterior was perfectly smooth, but Alastair could make out what he assumed were panels, which could be removed to gain access to the internal workings.
"Gentlemen, I present to you the galaxy's smallest and most efficient reactor," Anna said with a flourish. "If I'm reading the specs correctly, this little baby will change our complete understanding of energy production. Forget powering Arachnar in combat. This marvel of dustman engineering could supply all the power a battleship might need."
Tim could not help himself. He reached out a hand to touch the dark-as-night reactor, forgetting for a moment that he was wrapped in armor. From Anna's perspective, the sight of a giant metal fighting machine trying to softly stroke a piece of engineering which contained the equivalent of a small star within it, laughable. And that was exactly what she did. Surrounded by fighting men, devastation, and the dead, Anna's soft, lilting human laugh reminded them all what they would lose if General Pipo was successful. Gonzales Rivero brought Alastair back to reality with a very uncomfortable bump.
"Colonel, check 3rd Platoon status."
Alastair cursed himself for getting caught up in the moment and taking his eye off the ball. Flicking screens, the blood drained from his face as he double-checked what his suit's computer told him. Of the 9 troopers on the control room level, 7 were a solid, dark red of combat ineffective. 1, Carolyn Verleys, blinked amber, while only 1 remained a steady green. Corporal Okoro.
"Time's up, people!" shouted Alastair. "Tim, the reactor is your responsibility. Get it ready to move!"
Tim spun on his heel, taking the couple of steps it took to stand before the reactor.
"Roger that, Colonel. First Sergeant, you plus one are with me. Hustle it up. Jackson, on me!"
called Kroll, as he used his Casper's amplified muscles to literally rip the reactor from its mount, unconcerned if the thing blew up or not. Jackson arrived beside him and presented his back. Kroll deftly secured the reactor to the cargo hooks on the rear of Jackson's suit. Tim raced his eye over the reactor, ensuring it was securely attached.
"Good to go, Colonel."
"Wait, wait,"
cried Anna, causing Alistair to turn in her direction.
"We can't leave."
"Explain, Doctor,"
demanded Alistair.
"If we leave